Again, a few housekeeping announcements before we begin. This coming week, Monday through Thursday, Destiny is sponsoring a learning and relaxation retreat at the Royal Hotel at the Dead Sea. And there are a few rooms still available for those who are interested. And you can see Miriam. The relaxation has nothing to do with the fact that it's at the Dead Sea. The final two lectures in this series, there will not be a lecture next week because of the retreat, and there won't be a lecture the week after because it's Hanukkah. So the final two lectures will be on January 3rd and January 10th. January 3rd, the lecture will be about Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and January 10th, the lecture will be about Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmar Rebbe. And so you're all asked to please remember those dates, January 3rd and January 10th. Tonight's lecture is dedicated to the memory of Tzivia Bat Baruch Oleh HaSholom, whose yahrzeit is the 17th of Kislev. It's Racheli Miller's mother, and may these words serve as an aliyah for her neshama. Tonight's lecture is my personal reminiscences regarding one of the great men of the Jewish 20th century, Rabbi Yosef Shlomo HaKohen Kahaneman. Rav Kahaneman was known as the Podavizhia Rav due to the fact that he was the rabbi of Ponovitz in Lithuania from the end of the First World War until the Second World War. Ponovitz was the second largest Jewish community in Lithuania after Lithuania lost Vilna to the Poles. The main city was Kaunas, Kovna, the Jews called it, which was then the capital of Lithuania, and Ponovitz was the second largest city, had a Jewish population of close to 25,000 Jews, which in Lithuania was a great number for Jews because the entire Jewish population in Lithuania was between 330 and 350,000 Jews. Lithuanian Jewry was completely wiped out in the Holocaust, 99%. Very few survived it. Part of the reason was that before the Germans even came, the Russians came, the Soviets came in 1940, and they killed out all the rabbis and all of the Zionists and everybody that was going to prevent the great new world from coming into being. And then when the Russians fled in front of the German invaders, so the Lithuanians themselves killed out half of the Jewish population in Lithuania. So when the Germans came, it was already 50% done for them. And the Lithuanian Jewry was special. Was unique, was different than any of the other areas of Jewish life. And unfortunately, even though we say there is a Lithuanian section of Haredi or an Orthodox Jewry today, it really is not. Because the Lithuanian aspect and the Lithuanian attitude and way of life was completely destroyed. I remember that the Ponovitzia Rav told me that the German army made him the rabbi in Ponovitz in the First World War. When they came to Ponovitz in the First World War, so he said the Germans were very good to the Jews, and that German Jewish chaplains accompanied the German army, and the chaplains were Orthodox. And therefore the Germans rebuilt the mikveh, and the Germans fixed the Erev. The Germans did everything so that there would be an infrastructure for Jewish life. And the Germans, in their search for order, Ordnung, had to have somebody to talk to. And he was in town. The Rav Rebitzel Leponavizhar was dead already, and they hadn't found the news, so they said, "We're going to talk to you." And after the Germans left, after the end of the First World War, and Lithuania became independent, and the Jews, many Jews returned after the war, so he was, so to speak, we said, "I was already sitting on the chair." And he said with his winsome smile and the cleverness of life, he said, "Once a rabbi's on a chair, it's hard to get him off. Doesn't move so easily." So he was the Rav in Ponevish. I first met him in 1947. I wasn't even bar mitzvah yet. He came to Chicago. And he spoke in the yeshiva in Chicago, in the Beis Medrash LaTorah. And all the rabbonim from Chicago came. By then he already had a worldwide reputation. And I even remember the subject matter in the Talmud that he discussed, the Gemara in Bar Metzia. And because he made such an impression, he was the aristocrat's aristocrat. The glory of Torah shone from him. And also, he absolutely loved Jews, which is not an easy matter. And he loved them. He loved Jewish children. He loved Jews. All kinds of Jews. So he got up to speak. I remember all the rabbis from Chicago were there. It was a very impressive row of rabbonim that we had then. Most of them were European-born. All the Rashi Yeshiva were there. And they gathered all the Talmidim in the yeshiva. There were about 250 of us. So the Beis Medrash was full. And he spoke. When he finished the pilpul, when he finished the Gemara Shir, which he took about 45 minutes, and he had a very, very clear Litvish Yiddish, so you could understand him, at least we Litvaks understood him very, very clearly, very simply. He then said, it was almost eerie because Rav Herzog did the same thing when Rav Herzog came to the yeshiva. He said, after this, he said, "I want to speak to you. I want to talk to you for a few minutes." And he said that was the time when the Irgun and the Lehi were mounting their campaign against the British here in Eretz Yisrael to drive out England from the land of Israel. And I need not tell you how... what a terrible situation it was then. The English, with their 100,000 Jews, were in Cyprus in the prison camps. The British blockade was here. Jerusalem was divided by barbed wire. There was a section of Jerusalem was called Bevingrad, after the British Foreign Secretary, Ernest Bevin, one of the great anti-Semites in the 20th century. And the Arabs were blowing up, the Jerusalem Post building got blown up. And, it was not a sanguine time. We always suffer with our times, but if you look at it in an overall picture, it's, like we're ahead of the game quite a bit from where we started. So he said to us, he said, there are 7-10 Jews sitting in prison, in a British prison in Jerusalem and in Akko. He said, and I guarantee you, he said, "Vinach maftiach," I guarantee you that these 7-10 Jews are going to drive the English out of the land of Israel. That I guarantee it. And then he said, if I had 7-10 Jews that were as committed to build a Torah state as these people are committed to drive the British out of the land of Israel, we would have a Torah state. He said, but there aren't that 7-10 people. We don't have them. And this is what he said, I mean, Nevuah. He said, there's going to be a Jewish state. And he said, and it could very well be, I remember the words, you know, I was shocked. He said, it could very well be that for being a Shomer Shabbos, they'll put you in jail, the Jews. But there will be a Jewish state. And we have to see what we can do with it. That was my first exposure to the Pona Vizhirov. And I, you know, like I had never heard words like that before. And I was always precocious. And I was an only child in the house. So, you know, I was part of the adult discussion. And my parents were very involved. And we had, my grandmother lived here. My aunts and uncles lived here. And I remember my father came home. I came home with my father. I didn't go to school that day, which it was also a memorable experience. In Chicago, there was no such thing as a snow day, you know, because if there would be snow days, there would never be school. And, you know, you always went to school, no matter what. And I remember I came home with my father, and my mother said, so what did he say? And my father said over what he said. And my mother was a very strong woman. So she said, well, she said, he's certainly right that there's going to be a Jewish state, but I don't think that they'll put the Shomrei Shabbos in jail yet. That was the comment on the speech. I didn't see him again until 1964. In 1964, my wife and I and our children moved to Miami Beach. I became the Rav of what was then a small congregation that later, thank God, grew into a large congregation. And I was the Rav. And Miami Beach then bears almost no resemblance to Miami Beach now, Jewishly or generally. There were no such thing as condominiums, but there were kosher hotels. And the kosher hotels during the four-month season, as it was called, from Thanksgiving to Pesach, had Jews from all over the world, and most of the time very substantial Jews financially, who would come to spend the winter. And just as honey attracts flies and bees, rich Jews attract Rosh Yeshiva. And therefore the Rav, the Pona Vizhirov, would come in winter in Miami Beach. He'd spend three and a half months. He was in a kosher hotel. I remember the hotel very well. It was owned by one of the members in my congregation, and a number of the hotels were owned by members in my congregation. And So Pona Vizhirov is there. So I said to the owner of the hotel, I said, well, you know, could you arrange, you know, I'd like to meet him. I'd like to pay my respects to him. So he said, funny thing you mentioned it, because he asked me today, he wants to see you. I said, he wants to see me? He doesn't know me even from Adam. How does he know me? He said, no, he told me that I should find you. He wants to see you. So I went back in the automobile with the owner of the hotel, and the Rav is there in the lobby, and I came up to him. So the first thing he did was kiss me. Pona Vizhirov kissed every male that he ever saw. And he, you know, and it wasn't, there are people that, you know, there's three kinds. There are people that it's an act, it's phony, and you know it's an act, and they know it's an act. But my Rebbe used to say that, for Chanifa, Krikmanit Kimpach. nobody ever slapped somebody because they complimented him, right? So, all right, so we know it's a fake, but it's good. Then there's a second group of people who it's a fake, but the people whom they're faking don't realize that it's a fake. That's already a second level of achievement. But the Ponev Yerov, it was not a fake. He liked you. And you felt immediately that he was sincere. That's really what opened doors to him. And he would, when he would speak publicly, he would say, Briderlach, Schwesterlach, my brothers, my sisters, and you knew that he meant it. You were his brother, you were his sister. You ever said, ladies and gentlemen? And he said to me, he said, you know, Rabbi Wein, he said, I know you're busy, and I know the troubles that an American rabbi has. He told me, he said, Gleip Mir, believe me, Zakter, in Ponevizhia was easier than in Miami Beach, he told me. And the balabos from the hotel was standing, you know, like, when he spoke to you, he had one hand on you and one hand on the other guy, and he wouldn't let go because he wanted the other guy to hear it. And what he did for me personally is he forced my balabatim to think that they had a great rabbi. He literally forced it upon them. So he's holding the owner of the hotel's hand, and he's holding my hand, and he said, to be a rav in Miami Beach is such a hard thing, and it's so difficult, and look, and he's building the shul, and he's doing everything, and then he embraces me again. So the other guy, he all of a sudden looks at me a little differently. And he had that knack, wherever he went, that he helped the local rabbi. There are rabbonim that come to town, to a strange town, and destroy the local rabbi. The first thing they do is they say the Erev is no good. The mikveh is no good. The kashrus is no good. The rav is an amoritz. Happens all the time. It's a terrible thing, but it's true. There's a famous story. There was a great rav in Lithuania who was famous for doing this to all local rabbis. The truth of the matter is that he was a genius. He was greater than all of them, but he would come to town. So he came to a certain town. I don't want to mention any names. And the local rabbi left town. He heard he was coming. He left town. And he didn't come back to town until the guy left. So the balabatim said, why'd you leave? This great rav came here, etc. He said, if I would have stayed, I would have had to talk to him, and he would begin to talk in Torah and in learning, and then at the end he would say, he's an amoritz. I spoke to him in learning, he doesn't know anything. Like this, I wasn't here. So whatever he says about me, I say it can't be because he never spoke to me, right? How does he know what I know? The Ponev Yerov built up everybody. He just built them up. And he had a knack of doing it. So he says to me, he said, listen, I know how busy you are, etc. He said, but could you help me? He said, please help me. I said, Rebbe, whatever you want, you know, at Chatzia Malchus, whatever you want, I'll do for you. So he said, I need somebody to go with me 2-3 times a week in the morning. I have a whole list of people that I want to see in Miami Beach. Some are in the hotel, and some are in different hotels, and some live here permanently, and I don't want to go by myself. He said, I don't know English that well. Later on, I understood why he didn't want to go by himself. That wasn't the reason. He said, but if you'll go with me, and he said, and maybe if you'll drive, he said, that we won't have to hire a cab, you know. And I said, Rebbe, fine, it's my honor. So he said, we'll go from 9:30 to 12, and I remember what he, Monday and Wednesday, and then we went 3 times a week. I remember my Balabatim used to say, people used to come in 11 o'clock, where's the rabbi? So the secretary would say, he's chauffeuring the rabbi from Israel today. But it was more than being the chauffeur. It was absolutely more than that. It was the experience of a lifetime. We get in the car, and he would start giving me advice from the moment he closed the door and tell me his experiences. And like he always hit the nail on the head because he knew exactly what the problems were. And he used to tell me about the members of his congregation that he had in Ponevish and what they used to do. He told me once that they didn't pay him on time. So he said that he went on strike. He made a shvitah. He wouldn't answer shilas. So there were shilas, there were permanent personal shilas and marital shilas and all sorts. And he would, that's it. You don't pay, you have no rabbi. Until they succumbed and paid him. So he said that he learned that from the previous Rav, who also, the Aderes, Rav Cook's father-in-law, Rav Elio David Tumim Rabinowitz, who was a Rav here in Yerushalayim, that when the Aderes was the Rav in Ponevish, apparently in Ponevish, it's like working for the local municipalities in Israel, all right? They don't pay you. It was a bad habit that they had. Lest you think that everything was idyllic. People think Eastern Europe was home on the range, where the skies are not cloudy all day and nobody has a bad word to say. It wasn't like that. So they didn't pay the Aderet. And they didn't pay him for 16 weeks. And he simply didn't have food in the house anymore. And he couldn't borrow. He had borrowed of everybody he could. So he went on strike. He didn't take care of anything. So then there was, so it's all right not to pay the rabbi, but how are you going to drink milk if it's not Cholav Yisrael? And how are you going to eat meat if it doesn't have the stamp on it? And the mikveh, who checked the mikveh? And who took care of the Erev? He said, I'm on strike, till you pay me. So they wrote to Rabbi Yitzchak Chonon, who was then the great Rav in Kovna, and the head of the Lithuanian rabbinate, and they said, what do we do with our rabbi? He's on strike. And Rabbi Yitzchak Chonon wrote back and said, listen, when I was the Rav in the viaduct, they didn't pay me, I also went on strike. He's right, you're wrong. So it just so happened that the shul owed me money. And I don't know how he knew about it, but he knew everything. He knew everything that went on. So I said, Rebbe, I should go on strike? And he said, you don't have to go on strike. He said, you'll drive me 5 days a week. You'll never be there. You're always busy. You'll always be busy, he said. They can't get you. They'll call the Rebbetzin at home. Oh, I don't know. He had to go somewhere. They call in shul. He's out. So I said, Rebbe, are you serious? Ich lachnit, right? I'm not laughing here. I'm telling you what to do. He said, better than that, I'm going to tell the owner of the hotel that you're on strike. I said, Rebbe, and he did. He told him. He said, I told him that he should make a shvita. And the owner of the hotel that day came over with cash and paid me out of his own pocket everything that the shul owed. And they never fell behind again. Of course, then I raised the money, but nevertheless, they never fell behind again. And we had a wonderful relationship. In the car, he would tell me about himself. Apparently, he had no one to talk to. A Jew that went through, lost his family in the Shoah. His when we knew him, my wife and I, it was a second marriage with a wonderfully aristocratic woman from Switzerland. So he always used to say the posig in this week's parsha, "Kibamakli avarti asayarde nazeh." Yaakov Avinu said, when I came to Eretz Yisrael, I came only with my staff. I came with nothing. And now I have two camps. He said, now I have a great yeshiva, my son is here, and I have grandchildren, and I remarried again. So he said, how can I complain to God? Then he once told me, he had a diplomatic passport because he was a member of the Lithuanian parliament. He was elected as a representative of Orthodox Jewry, and he was a member of the Lithuanian parliament. He told me that he knew Lithuanian, but that he purposely spoke only Yiddish in the parliament. And he said they were all anti-Semites. It was just terrible. But he had this diplomatic passport. And in a screwy world, such as we live in a world that makes no sense, so the Soviets recognized the diplomatic status, and the Germans recognized the diplomatic status. And he was able to get out with his son. And he had made arrangements, he got certificates for his wife and his family that they should follow him within a week. But within the week, the war with Russia broke out, the German war with Russia, and they disappeared in the maelstrom of what happened. So he said, I came to Eretz Yisrael. I remember he told me the story in the car. He said, well, I came to Eretz Yisrael. So he said, I'm already old, I'm broken, I'm widowed, I've lost my children, my kehila is destroyed. So I thought to myself, what should I do? He used to say about himself, Vozel Yesev Shleime Kahanamin, Vozel Erton. What should I do? So I said to myself, I'm going to rebuild everything that was destroyed. There were 18 yeshivas in Lithuania, 18 major yeshivas. I'm going to build 18 major yeshivas. In his lifetime, he built 3. But I'm going to rebuild it. That's what I'm here for. So he said there was a large empty hill in Bnei Brak. The Bnei Brak then was as big as a peanut. It was basically the neighborhood of Zichron Meir, where the Chazon Ish lived. And before the great influx of Jews, religious Jews, moved out of Tel Aviv and moved to Bnei Brak. So he said, I bought this hill. I bought it, he said, very, very cheap, because who wanted to own a hill in Bnei Brak? It had no value. And this is 1943. And 1943, the war is on. And he said, and Rommel and the Africa Corps are at El Alamein. They're 100 kilometers from the borders of the land of Israel. He said to me, and the British are burning the papers, you know, and they're getting ready, they're going to move to Iraq. They're going to abandon us. And every day, the Italian and German planes flew over Tel Aviv. So sometimes they dropped bombs. People don't remember that. But sometimes they dropped leaflets. And in the leaflets they said, you know, we killed all the Jews in Poland. You're next. And so he said, I bought this piece of land. And I was going to have a cornerstone laying for the yeshiva. And I invited all the rabbis, everybody to come, and all the Zionist officials, everybody to come, the mayor of Tel Aviv, you know, Rokach, I invited them all to come. We're going to lay the cornerstone for Ponovish Yeshiva. So he said, so they came and we had a ceremony, we had a tekes, it was very nice and everything. He said, when it was over, one of the great rabbis said to me, he said, you're crazy. He said, in 10 days, Rommel is here. Who are you building a yeshiva for? So he said to me, well, what? So what do you think I answered him, Rabbi Wein? And I, Rabbi, he said, I told him the Jewish people need a yeshiva even for 10 days. And he said, and Rommel didn't come, and they didn't destroy us, and the yeshiva stayed. And the yeshiva is there. So he said, you have to realize, if you have an opportunity to do something, do it. Everybody will come over and say, don't do it. And that's, I remember that many times in my rabbinic experience, that whenever a rabbi has a good idea, a lot of naysayers who are nice people, good people, fine people, when they come over and they say, you know, do you have the money? How are you going to do it? The neighbors will complain. Do we really need this? 100 reasons no. So he said, if you have an opportunity to do something for Torah, do it. And he said, you'll see that God will count it and it'll turn out for you. And his words were prophetic. We had a little mesifta in Miami Beach. Rabbi Rotman founded it, and then Rabbi Gross and I headed it. And we didn't have a farthing to our name. We weren't able to put any money, so we all worked, we all taught for nothing, everything. And it was a peanut of a place. And all the people came to us and said, you know, it's not in Miami Beach. And we kept it open. It's still open today. A lot of good people came out of it. But it's open because of what he said to me. He said, you have an opportunity. I talked to him. I said, Rebbe, maybe. So he said, well, it's right there, up there, you know. He said, you got 25 boys that come to learn Torah. So what do you want? And he used to visit the yeshiva. It was called the Masif, the Greater Miami. He would come to visit it. And our student body then had no concept of who this bearded Jew was. And he walked around, he kissed every student, and he went home. You know, that was it. That was the speech. He had such a relationship with people. I mean, I'll tell you two incidents that I knew myself. We had a Jew in our shul, wonderful Jew from Teaneck, New Jersey, before Teaneck was Teaneck. And he was really an outstanding person. He was a great labor lawyer in his prime. When he was in his early 50s, he suffered a massive heart attack. And then 2 years later, he had a malignant tumor that the doctors practically gave up on. And when somehow he pulled through these two things, so the doctors told him, listen, move to Florida. We don't think you have many years left, but, you know, to stay in the snow and ice of New Jersey in the winter, move to Florida. So he moved to Florida. And he bought an annuity for himself. The annuity paid him an income until age 90. When I knew him, when I first came to Miami Beach and he was a member in our shul, he was such a wonder, I can't describe to you what a wonderful person. Clever, astute, a good Jew. So he was 88. Still going strong. The doctors were already in the cemetery, but he was still going strong. And he was a great supporter of the Ponovizhia Rav. Every time we went to him, he gave us $5,000, which then was a lot of money. Today it's also money. And the Ponovizhia Rav would go to him like 2-3 times in the winter, and every time he'd write out the check for $5,000. I realized that he turned 90. He had no children, a very distant family. He turned 90. So then he has only his Social Security. He can't write out checks for $5,000. So the Ponovizhia Rav said to me one morning, he said, "Kunt miram gainzenheim, we're going to go see him." I said, "Rebbe, we can't go see him." He said, "Why can't we go see him?" So I told him, because his annuity ran out, he can't write $5,000 checks. I said, and I don't know if he even has money to live on. He's got this big house, and he's used to a certain standard in living. So the Ponovizhia Rav said to me, "Oh, medafen gainzen, we have to go and see him." I said, "Rebbe," he said, "no, leave him, get in the car, we're going." So we went, you know, and I got such a heavy heart, like that was so out of character for the Ponovizhia Rav, you know, to do that to somebody. And I ring the bell, and the man opens the door, and he sees us, and his face falls to the floor. Because he knows that he can't write the check. And the Ponovizhia Rav embraces him, and sits down, and he says to him, "Come, we'll have a glass of tea together." And then he says to him straight, he says, "I want you to know, when you had money, you supported the yeshiva. Now that you don't have money, I put you today on the payroll of the yeshiva. The yeshiva will mail you the amount of the annuity every month. And you should live to 120. And kach have it. That is exactly what happened. And the man died, it was 96 or 97 when he died. He left his house on Pine Tree Drive, which was a substantial house worth a lot of money. He left it to the yeshiva. And the Ponovizhia Rav, when I saw him in Eretz Yisrael, so he said, "I told you that it would come out good, right? What are you worried about, right?" "Like, it's an investment," he said. But what a thing. You helped us, now it's our turn. I mean, where does the yeshiva give money to anybody? And later I found out that most of the money was his personal money. It wasn't even the yeshiva's money. I have so many stories of people that we met together. It was a Jew, wonderful Jew from Chicago, whom I knew, who made a fortune. He owned a wine company, and he made a fortune selling kosher wine to the Afro-American population in the United States. And when he was like 80 years old, an old Litvish Jew couldn't speak English well. I remember he got up at a yeshiva banquet once and he said, "We have to raise more money from intuition." He was a wonderful person, such a nice man, wonderful person. And he was a big supporter of the Rav. And the Rav had a way that, you know, if you saw, he didn't see you once in the winter. He saw you a number of times in the winter. So he said, "We're going to go see Mr. So-and-so today." And I knew Mr. So-and-so anyway from Chicago. In fact, I'm indebted to him all of my life, because when I went to the yeshiva, I and my parents, we didn't have any money to pay any money to the yeshiva at all. And he paid for a scholarship for me for 10 years. So I helped take care of him in his later years in Miami Beach, he and his wife. Again, they had no children. And So he sold his business to a large conglomerate, a big company, and he got $40 million for the business. That $40 million in the 1960s was really, that was heavy money. So we went to see him, and the Punavidyarov explains to him that he's going to build this, and he's going to build that, and we have to, you know, and everything. And the man says to him, Rebbe, I'd love to help you, but I have no income anymore. Because he's a chavnik in business. I don't have a business anymore, right? Where am I going to write the check from? So I remember the Punavidyarov enjoyed that so much, he rolled on the floor almost in laughter. Then he said to him, don't worry, I'll show you where you should take the money from. He said, du hast a bissel stock, he said. You got a little stock? He said, get me the stock. And he got, I remember we got a tremendous amount of money out of it, and he was very happy to give it. He told me, the Punavidyarov, that when you ask a Jew for money for Torah, you should never feel embarrassed, and you should never feel ashamed. You are doing him the favor. You're doing him the favor. And he said, in the world to come, they'll ask you, how come you didn't ask him for money? If you had asked him for money, he would have given it to you. So he said, I'll tell you a story with the Chofetz Chaim. He was very close with the Chofetz Chaim. He studied under him. So he told me the story that the Chofetz Chaim once went to a Jew who was building yeshiva in Radin. Radin burned down like every 5 years, the whole town, because it was all wooden thatched roofs and, you know, next to each other. And in the summer, one good lightning struck, and the whole town went under. So he wanted to build a brick building, you know, that a fireproof building, so the yeshiva would have a building. So he went to collect money from people. So he came to a rich Jew, and he tells him he's building the building, and he wants him to contribute and everything, and the Jew says, Rebbe, you know, and things are tight now, I don't have, I'm not liquid, but he said, I'll tell you what, I'll put you in my will. Which is always optimistic. You should never say that to anyone because then you don't know what they're going to pray for. So the Chofetz Chaim told the Punavidyarov, so I have my mobile lost. I let him go, right? I didn't press the matter. He said, came the First World War and the Communist Revolution, so this guy got wiped out completely, naturally. And he said, the Chofetz Chaim had gone into exile from Lithuania all the way deep into Russia. I know my father-in-law, blessed memory, went with him. And then after the war, they tried to get back into Poland. They didn't get back till 1920. All sorts of things to get smuggled across the border to come back. So there were thousands of Jewish refugees on the roads. And they were subject to all the terrible things, the depredations of the Red Army and the White Army and Stam robbers. It was just a terrible time. So Jews used to sleep in the shul. That was the, you know, you'd come to a town, you had nowhere to stay, you had nowhere to, so they would sleep in the shul. So the Chofetz Chaim said, we went in the shul to sleep in the Ezras Noshim, and I saw this Jew. The former rich man. So he said, I turned away from him because I didn't want to shame him. But he saw me. And he came over to me and he said, Rebbe, I have a great complaint to you. See, the Chofetz Chaim said, you have a complaint to me? What did I do? He said, Rebbe, and he said it in Yiddish, it gedaft a royce rice in the geld. You should have ripped the money out of me. Shouldn't have let me go. So he said, I remember that the Chofetz Chaim told me that. I'm doing him a favor. He'll come after Elam HaEmes. He'll be able to say he gave money for Achzokas HaTorah, for strengthening Torah by Klal Yisrael. He said, so the angel will kiss him. So you should never be embarrassed to ask money, because you're doing the favor. That's a very important lesson. He told me that many times he wanted to be the Rav in his hometown. Later on he became the Rav in Vidz, and then after Vidz he was the Rav in Ponovich. But his hometown, he came from a town, Kulia. Little peanut of a town in Lithuania. But everybody has a dream of going back home and, you know, making good in your hometown. And he said he tried a number of times to be elected the Rav there, and he never got elected the Rav. They refused to take him. So after he became the great Ponovich Rav, he asked them, how come? Why didn't you take me? So they said, well, we couldn't take you because there were people in town who still remembered that you played marbles, that you were a child in the town. We can't have a Rav that people remember that. So he said, remember that, he said. He told me, he said, never become a Rav in Chicago, he said. They'll remember that you played marbles. He had great conversations with Ben-Gurion. He had a great relationship, I would say. He was asked, what does the Ponovich Yeshiva do on Yom HaAtzmaut? So he said, I do like Ben-Gurion. No Tachnun, no Hallel. He flew, and I think it's still true today, he flew the Israeli flag over the mast of the yeshiva, over the roof of the yeshiva on Yom HaAtzmaut. So he told me, he said, the moral squad in Bnei Brak came to visit him. And he said, in Bnei Brak, to fly the Israeli flag, Yom HaAtzmaut, what are you, not the yeshiva yet? Whenever he would tell me a story, then he said, he would always ask, and what do you think I said to them, Rabbi Wein? You know, like I'm supposed to figure out what the Ponovich Rav would say. So he said, you know what I told him? He said, in Lithuania, on Lithuanian Independence Day, we flew the Lithuanian flag from the roof of the yeshiva in Ponovich. Then he said it in Yiddish. He said, Do is nit erger. Here it's not worse than it was in Lithuania. And that was such because that's a whole attitude that almost is non-existent today. To figure it out that here it's not worse. Forget about whether it's better. Forget about that it's not what it should be. That's not the question. It's not worse. And if you did it there, then how can you not do it here? He told me that once he had a conversation with Ben-Gurion, this is a little more sophisticated, his word here, and Ben-Gurion told him, he said, Kvod HaRav, Kvar Ein Lanu Bayot Gdolot, we don't have any great problems anymore, Yesh Lanu Bitachon, we have an army and we have security here. So the Ponovich Rav said to him, Yesh Li Bitachon. So the Ben-Gurion said to him, I said, bitochon, bitachon, it's the same thing. He said, no, he said, echod mil rav, echod milel. Which means, mil ra is bad, and milel means something good. But mil ra, milel is also the accent on how you say the word. So he said, bitachon, that's called mil ra. And he said, bitochon, that's Milel. That is, so we have Bitochen, he said. You know, our Bitochen's from on top, not from the army. He was a driven person. When I knew him, he had undergone a cancer operation. He had only one kidney left. He called it his Bas Yechida. his only daughter. He said, "Echamno chabash yechida," you say. And I remember he said to me once, he said, "I want you to organize." He said, "You have young people in your shul." So we had a wonderful shul in Miami Beach. We had the perfect demographic breakdown. We had a third of the shul were retired people, so we always had a minyan and people for shiurim, etc., and people who had money. And then a third of the people were middle-aged working people. And then a third of the people were younger people with younger children just starting out. So he said, "I want you to organize a meeting. I want to come talk to the younger people." I said, "Rebbe, the younger people don't have money. You know, they're just starting out and they have to pay tuition in the schools. And they don't have money. You know, you mean that I should make a meeting with the retired people?" No, "Ich weiß was ich rede," he said to me. "I know what I'm talking about." "Okay, you want to make a meeting? We'll make a meeting." So we made a meeting in the home, and the men are in Freund's own Beide Kumen. He wants the men and the women, they should both come. And tell him, "Nit vergelt, I don't want any money from them." So I organized the meeting. It was in the home of one of the younger couples, and about 30, 35 couples came. Very lovely evening, and they served nice and everything. Then he got up to speak. And he said to them, he said, "Meine Kinder, my children, listen to me." He said, "There are 1.5 million neshamas of Jewish children under the age of 12 that were killed in the Holocaust." He said, "Those neshamas are looking for bodies. So you have to give them bodies." And it was like, bah! Who talks like that, right? And he went around the room and he said, "You listened? You heard what I said? You heard what I said?" And we had a dramatic increase in the birth rate in Beis Torah. I mean, in Beth Israel. He said, "How are we going to have a Jewish people without Jews?" And that was his speech to them. I remember one of the boys that was born, way after he had passed away, someone called me from Miami Beach and said, "I want to name my son after the Ponovizhia Rav. Tell me what his name was." He was very close to my wife and to me. He spent time in his home, he and his Rebbetzin. We made luncheons for him in our home. When we visited Eretz Yisrael, we ate Shabbos by him, which was a special experience. He gave us a silver platter on which was engraved the picture of the building of the Ponovitch Yeshiva. And he signed it in silver. And we used the silver platter every Shabbos on our table. And I've always felt that as long as the platter is there, he's there with me, right? Still have a piece of him with me. And he wanted me to go to Eretz Yisrael with him. He offered us a villa in Bnei Brak. That's like an oxymoron, but he meant it. That there was going to, he was going to build this great villa for my wife and I and our children, and that I should help him in the yeshiva with fundraising, with administration, and go to America with him, etc. I didn't take up the offer. I don't know whether I know how to be judged for that, but I did not take up the offer. But I was flattered beyond words that the offer came to me, that he thought that highly of me, that he was willing to entrust such a position excuse me, such a position in the yeshiva to me. He had a Jew in Chicago, a very wealthy Jew, owned a chain of haberdashery stores, who was a big supporter upon of his yeshiva. And the Jew, took ill, and he had a very serious operation. And he, after the operation, he was, for a while, he hovered between this world and the next. So the family called up the Ponovizh Rav that he should pray for him, should remember him in his prayers. So one morning, the Rav says to me, "Kum, ich darf gehen zum airport." We're talking here in the 1960s when you could go to the airport in 15 minutes and there was no searches or anything. You just got on the plane and you went. Ich fuhr in Chicago. So he came to Chicago. The man was still in the intensive care or recovery or whatever. Ponovizh Rav sat by the bed until they wheeled him in. And he opened his eyes, and like the first person that he saw was the Ponovizh Rav. So he said to him, "Oy, ich bin ich Yenevel chain," right? He thought he's in heaven already. And Ponovizh Rav said, no, mir sind in da. And the man couldn't get over, because the Rav was not a young man, and it was still a propeller plane then. But the Ponovizh Rav had a tremendous loyalty for those who were loyal to him, a reciprocal loyalty. And if the man was sick and was in the hospital, so he could have called him up, could have sent him a note. But he got on the plane and he went. And I know from the man's family that it speeded his recovery. The Ponovizh Rav told me he went back to Israel, and then he came back the next house. He said, "I want to tell you a story." He said, "Interesting thing." He said, "I'm making yeshiva in Ashdod. There's a yeshiva in Ashdod, the Grodno yeshiva, which is attached to Ponovizh. Big yeshiva. It's not as big as the one in Bnei Brak, but it's a big yeshiva, hundreds and hundreds." And he was negotiating with the mayor of Ashdod for a piece of land, you know, the city should donate a piece of land to build the yeshiva. And he had the deal all done. He thought he had it done. He came to Miami Beach, and when he came back to Israel, the deal was not done. He had left his son in charge to finish the deal, and it didn't happen. So then the Ponovizh Rav took the matter in his own hands, and he went to the mayor, and they arranged it, and it went through. So then the mayor said to him at the end, he said, "I don't understand." He said, "I negotiated with your son for 6 months and nothing happened. And you came in 2 weeks and it's all done and we're all happy. What happened?" So the Rav said, "You don't understand. My father was a businessman. His father's a Rosh Yeshiva." And he had that ability. He had the ability to cut through everything. If one was fortunate enough to know such a person, so even in the darkest moments, even the most depressing times, one has a good feeling if you're working in the field of Torah, if you're working for the Jewish people. He used to say, "Miami Beach, up there, over there. Miami Beach, Miami Beach. Well, how can it compare to Eretz Yisrael?" He used to say, "Eretz Yisrael." He used to say, "The sunlight there is different than here." And he said, "And we're building there." And that message of hope, that message of greatness, of optimism, and of good rational litvak, good sense, that's a tremendous gift. And I'm grateful to the Lord that I had the opportunity. I'm sorry I didn't drive him around more. But every moment of it is a treasure to me and an inspiration. And the great yeshiva that he built, one of the great yeshivas in the world, stands in his schus, and it can't be destroyed no matter what others do to it. Because of the greatness of this person and his faith in God and in the Jewish people and in the eternity of Torah. Thank you. So January 3rd and January 10th are the final two lectures. Myriv.
So we're not going to meet a lecture until next year.
That's true.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think it's beautiful. I really think it's beautiful.
And I'll probably put a plaque on the wall next to your cabinet.
Fine.
Fascinating. That's all.
Thank you.
Fascinating.
Yeah, thank you.
You need a chazan for Myriv. Go ahead. I doubt
it. I remember
revolutionary. Yeah, yeah.